So this week life caught up with me. So you're gonna see about two-thirds of the way through the slides, the quality of the presentation is gonna nosedive. Actually, it's right when we get to Bell's theorem, which you should all know anyways. Okay, so last two lectures we saw a whole bunch about the historical perspectives and everything pre-1950 pretty much. So what we're gonna do now is take a look at what how people think about interpretations now, just a quick overview, and kind of focus in on what I consider to be the most interesting part of this, which is what are the possibilities for hidden variable models for quantum mechanics, and what are the constraints on those hidden variables? Okay, so this isn't necessarily organized as well as it could be, but I'm going to start by just giving a quick kind of, 2 minute flash overview of some of the major modern interpretations, and then start discussing, well, what does it mean to interpret a theory in a more sophisticated way? And we'll look at, exactly what the kind of practical operational interpretation of quantum mechanics is, and discuss kind of what's the minimal interpretation you need to use quantum mechanics. And then from there, we'll start talking about what does it mean to start to make to say more than that, to start making ontological statements about what's really going on. And we'll look at some of the basic issues there. We'll digress and look at classical physics and see how to interpret that. And it actually ends up being a kind of a non-trivial exercise. You learn something really more subtle about how the quantum theory can be interpreted. We're going to look at some simple examples of ontological models for quantum theory. Cauchy-Specker model and the Beltrametti-Bujasky model, which somehow didn't make it on there. And then we'll start discussing constraints on hidden variables and, in particular, non-locality. I doubt we'll have time to get to contextuality, so I'll leave that for some assignment work. So, as you'll recall, the measurement problem over the orthodox interpretation caused a lot of unease for generations of physicists. So on the one hand, you have the kind of orthodox view where you have this kind of unexplained collapse, and on the other hand, you have the kind of Copenhagen view where you have to divide the world into the quantum part and the classical part. And so this kind of tension or despair has led to a whole bunch of alternative and mutually incompatible solutions to the measurement problem. So, at least, most of them are necessarily wrong by kind of logical exclusion. One of the main themes that motivates these interpretations is to overcome the measurement problem, to come up with, in particular, an interpretation where the active observation does not have a distinguished role. So the measurer is not outside the theory. So the first interpretation that I'll just quickly go over is the many worlds interpretation. You've probably all heard a little bit about it. It's been kind of made fun of as the many words interpretation. The origin of it is from Hugh Everett, who in 1957 proposed this idea of what he called the relative state interpretation. The basic idea is that, when the quantum system evolves and the state vector splits into a coherent superposition, that reality itself mimics this process. So here we're again taking kind of, it's in the spirit of the literal realism of von Neumann, that somehow the state vector is fundamentally what's going on in the world, but in this case, it's what's going on in many worlds at the same time. So it's a reality that spans more than our reality. The kind of the basic idea is that you don't have a measurement problem in this case, unlike von Neumann, because the observer, remember when we looked at the measurement problem formally, where you had this coherent superposition of pointer being left, atom decaying, pointer being left, and so on. The idea is you just add the observer as a quantum system there, and then you have the observer is in a superposition, just like the cat, of seeing the pointer to the left or seeing the pointer to the right. And so within the kind of self-consistent perspective of one of these branches of the superposition, the observer sees only the one outcome, the one the observer of that branch sees that outcome, and the kind of copy of the observer in another branch sees the other outcome. So, I mean, it's something Asher Perez calls just a bizarre interpretation, and I agree with that. But so we'll get to see someone who believes it seriously. Lev Weidman will come and talk about it in March, and David Wallace spoke about it in 2005 for this course. So you can see David Wallace's lectures as well. And it actually, in spite of, you know, my misgivings, it's actually very popular amongst physicists. Are there any quick questions about that?
It just replaces the, I mean, von Neumann kind of says with this process one, oh, the collapse just happens.
Yeah.
And he's saying collapse doesn't happen. Reality just splits.
Yeah. Well, it's just, again, it's a gentle pillow, right? It's something so you can say, okay, well, this is what's going on. But it doesn't kind of add anything to our understanding. I agree. Oh, yes. I mean, you get a very different picture of the world, for one. And I mean, all these, I mean, yeah. Okay. I don't know what else to say about it. Yes?
Is there any interaction between these so-called branches?
Well, I guess yes. I mean, the point is we know that you can recombine systems. You can create coherent superpositions and then recombine them. At the atomic scale, at least, we can do this in the lab. So what that means ontologically, I don't know. But I would ask you, Adam, and I'm sorry, what's your name? Matthew. Please ask these questions to Lev Weidman when he comes, okay? So there's also decoherence-based interpretations. So here, it's very fashionable to include decoherence as kind of a primitive element in understanding what is real or what the possible realities are. There's such a thing called the preferred basis problem. So remember, I mentioned in an earlier lecture the ambiguity of mixtures. So if I have a mixed state, I can decompose it as a convex combination of pure states, but that decomposition is never unique. So even though I can show via, say, some mechanism that the state is a convex combination of pure states, and I can say, ah, this is just some classical probability distribution over different ontic states, the problem is it's not clear from quantum mechanics what the right distribution is. Not only is it not unique, there's actually an infinite number of different decompositions you can make. That's called the ambiguity of mixtures. And so one of the jobs of decoherence is to pick out a preferred mixture for you. And this plays a significant role in the so-called existential interpretation advocated by Wojciech Zurek, which trades on variations of the many worlds view, and also plays a critical role in the decoherent consistent histories formalism that was developed by Griffiths, Roland Omnes, Gell-Mann, and Hartle. And so we had Bob Griffiths come talk about this, the consistent histories interpretation, back in 2005. Jim Hartle was going to talk about it this year, but had to cancel. And we've been bugging Wojciech Zurek to come talk to us for a while now with no success. So another important approach, contemporary approach, well, I don't know how important it is, but certainly a contemporary approach, is dynamical collapse models. So actually the mathematics of these models is quite interesting. The physics, I'm not so sure. The basic idea is to add a new term to the Schrodinger equation, in particular a nonlinear term. That what that does is it actually induces the wave function when it's in a superposition, say a macroscopic superposition, it drives it to a single value of that superposition. So what happens is this is actually a modification of the theory rather than an interpretation. Usually in interpretation, you take quantum mechanics as being correct, and maybe you'll add other mathematical elements to it. Well, not necessarily add, identify different mathematical elements as being significant, but you don't change the theory. So this is actually a modification of the theory. So it's actually proposing a new theory. In this picture, I guess in a way it is. I mean, there are different types of models. I'm not familiar with the details of all of them, but some of them imagine there's some kind of hidden variable that causes the collapse, I believe, but don't quote me on that. So because it's a different theory, it's in principle falsifiable. It's subject to experimental test, unlike, say, the many worlds interpretation, which you can't falsify. The problem in practice is that decoherence, from the point of view of the experimentalist, decoherence is going to destroy coherent superpositions. And so if you're randomly either dynamically collapsing into one of these elements of the superposition and thereby destroying the coherence between the two possible outcomes, or if that's happening due to, you know, dust particles in the system, it's very difficult to distinguish the two. So it's very difficult to falsify the theory. And it's not even clear how to do it, at least not to me. So one thing which I find kind of ironic about the whole idea is that, you know, it basically takes seriously the von Neumann eigenvalue eigenstate link. It takes seriously this idea that, you know, the literal reality of the world is the wave function. And then, of course, that confronts the measurement problem. So rather than saying, okay, well, we made a mistake with this assumption of literal realism, they believe it so strongly that they actually change the theory to fit the interpretation rather than just, you know, realize the interpretation is a bad interpretation. So that's that approach. And Philip Pearl came in 2005, and I've got all these wires now. Philip Pearl came in 2005 and discussed his version of dynamical collapse, which he calls the CSL model for continuous spontaneous localization. I'd invite you to review those lectures on the archive, on the web. Again, the mathematics of nonlinear Schrodinger equations is quite interesting for various reasons. And so it's worth understanding it just for that reason. The other popular approach in this vein is the GRW scheme, named after Girardi, Rimini, and Weber. I don't know if I pronounced those names very well. It proposes a different mechanism. And I only have a vague understanding of this, but Roger Penrose, I believe, has also proposed the kind of dynamical collapse model based on gravitational effects.
Such a spontaneous collapse model, are quantum computers possible?
No, they'd be limited in their scope. Actually, you just wouldn't be able to build a massive superposition of many, many qubits. There'd be some threshold beyond which you just couldn't do it. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, actually, I didn't think about the actually threshold theorem in this context, so maybe that would save you. But on the other hand, when I say no, I mean it's not scalable in principle. But because of quantum mechanics, classical computers aren't scalable either. Right? So the idea is, you know, where that bound is, it could be impractically, you know, far away, that it's irrelevant. But again, it depends on the specifics of the model. So last but not least is the statistical interpretation. So this is an interpretation that was kind of formalized by Leslie Ballantyne in 1970. He actually wrote a paper on, you know, entitled The Statistical Interpretation for RevMod Phys, and had a lot of trouble getting it published. And it's actually the only paper I know of which has a cover page. You know, you open the journal, you get to the article, and there's a cover page that says, basically, I can't remember the exact wording, but that there was disagreement about the editor, within the editors, about whether or not this was suitable as a physics publication. But nonetheless, they published it. So, I mean, because it was focused not on, you know, physics, but on interpretation. So there was, at the time, a culture that was very much kind of critical or skeptical about the value of interpretations. So in this view, the defining feature, and as Ballantyne puts it, he's basically taking Einstein's idea and kind of formalizing it. The defining feature is to reject the orthodox views, is to say, look, it's not correct to think that quantum states given a complete account of the ontology of the world. In other words, quantum states don't describe completely an individual system. Rather, they describe the statistical properties of ensembles of systems. So because in this kind of limited sense, the interpretation makes no actual ontological commitments. It doesn't have a measurement problem. Remember, the measurement problem comes from the fact that you start saying what's real in the theory, and then you have this disconnect between what you know to be real and what the theory tells you is real. Now, implicitly, I know Ballantyne has at least privately told me this, and I didn't bother to reread his paper to see if he actually said it anywhere in the article or elsewhere, but the way he puts it is that the statistical interpretation is consistent with the existence of hidden variables, although it doesn't explicitly endorse any particular hidden variables. So it's kind of a fence-sitter interpretation in the sense that it kind of leaves the question of hidden variables unspecified, and it's just consistent with that. Certainly, in the quotes we saw from Einstein, he would very much supported the idea that, you know, the future direction of physics was to find the more complete specification. So unlike Ballantyne, Einstein was quite clear that he thought that there should be hidden variables underlying quantum mechanics. That wasn't last but not least. So last but not least, oh, sorry, Victor.
So in the statistical interpretation, if you don't add in the extra bit where you say your ontology is specified by hidden variables, are you just, like, you've done the fundamental thing you object to and abandon the notion of reality altogether, right? Because you've now said quantum mechanics is no longer described as something ontological. Like quantum mechanics is describing an underlying reality in the Ballantyne interpretation, but if I'm understanding you correctly, right? So if you don't, that doesn't actually solve any problems. It just kind of shifts the problem to somewhere else where you have to say, well, now I need to come to the theory that does.
Okay, so I agree with you on many levels. So first of all, it does solve problems in the sense that, in the historical context of when Ballantyne did this was one where pretty much everyone that he would talk to, for example, would think quantum states were real and would interpret them as literally real objects. So to some extent, what he's trying to do is undo the damage of the inappropriate ontological commitments of the hegemonic viewpoint at the time, which and probably still today. So it in a sense, and in a sense, there's value in that, because if you think about it, if you're good, you know the way it goes when you debate with people that have strong views. The way you object to what they say is by proposing an alternative, say some concrete theory like the Bohmian mechanics view, then by showing you that particular ontological view is wrong, they kind of can resort back to their previous conception in spite of its difficulties. But so if you take a very conservative view and say, well, I don't know what the hidden variables are, but at the very least, if we want to interpret quantum mechanics correctly, we should not interpret it ontologically, then you're kind of, you're taking a conservative position, which allows you to...
Right, but a phrase like that, the statistical interpretation seems less an interpretation, more just a criticism of the interpretation.
And as I'll point out later, it's basically just the... taken at face value, it's just the kind of operational interpretation of quantum mechanics that we need to do quantum mechanics. And so, as you'll see later, what I'll call the operational interpretation is actually the minimal statistical interpretation, in the sense that you don't want to do what Einstein and Ballantyne suggest, which is, necessarily commit yourself to the view that there are hidden variables, because that's not necessary. So I would differentiate the statistical interpretation from the standard operational interpretation in that it goes a bit further and suggests there should be hidden variables, although we don't know what they are. Yeah.
Yes, if I remember correctly, I think even in Ballantyne's textbook, it's in there, he says that he can actually talk about individual systems if he thinks of the probabilities in terms of propensities.
That's Popper, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm guessing maybe that's what he means when he says that he can accommodate some hidden variable theory so that that hidden variables will explain why the propensities be like this or like that.
Yeah, it's consistent with hidden variables. You have to be careful, though, about... I don't know what Popper thought exactly with his propensity view, if it was consistent with hidden variables or not. It may have been just taking quantum mechanics literally, and so I'm not sure. Okay, so Bohmian mechanics. So we saw last class how Bohm was writing a textbook on quantum mechanics in 1951 and convinced himself that hidden variables were impossible, and then the next year constructed this, you know, this pilot wave theory, which is basically a hidden variable theory for quantum mechanics. So in this theory, it's called the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation because de Broglie had proposed the basic idea of the pilot wave theory back in 1927 at this famous Solvay conference, or maybe a bit earlier to that. And the problem is, I think it only worked under really for really restricted situations, like one dimension or something like that. And what Bohm did is, you know, kind of rediscovered this theory or further developed it to construct an interpretation which worked for all quantum mechanical phenomena. And so in this interpretation, particles do have definite positions and momenta at all times. And these are hidden variables because they're not manifest in their standard kind of mathematical formulation. You don't need them to do quantum mechanics. And these hidden variables, these positions and momenta, just like in classical physics, evolve deterministically according to dynamical laws and actually account for the definite measurement outcomes that you get when you do a measurement. So there's no measurement problem because we're not saying the state is ontic in the sense of it's not literally real. But the quantum state, the wave function psi, does have an ontic role in this hidden variable theory. So the hidden variables are the positions and the momenta. Those are properties of the particles. But the reason why the trajectories in the theory for the position and momenta, which basically follow the classical Hamiltonian, reproduce the quantum mechanical predictions instead of classical physics is because the wave function has a dual role. On the one hand, it describes the lack of knowledge you have about the preparation of the positions and the momenta via the Born rule. And on the other hand, it creates a potential that permeates throughout space. And this is an additional potential called the quantum potential, which adds linearly with the standard potential from whatever electromagnetic interactions you have, and guides the particles to follow different trajectories than those prescribed by classical mechanics. And so in this way, it cleverly reproduces the interference pattern you see in a double slit experiment, for example. So the interpretation is explicitly non-local. Yes, Luke?
What does this say about the uncertainty principle? Like, where does that fit into Boolean?
It's the uncertainty principle. It's very much like the way Heisenberg described it, where Heisenberg talked about, well, you have some position of momentum, but due to the fact that you have back reaction and, you know, you have the fact that light is quantized, your inability to know the position and the momentum precisely is what the uncertainty principle tells you, rather than the fact that these objects have a fuzzy ontology spread out through space or something like that. So it's exactly the kind of thing that Bohr didn't like about Heisenberg's way of thinking. So in 2005, this Bohmian interpretation it's a very deep theory. It has lots of work has been done on it. And it was presented by Shelley Goldstein in 2005. And this year, Roderick Tomilka will come talk to us about it. So you'll get two lectures on that. Okay, so that was the quick synopsis. Chris? I wouldn't consider myself to understand the theory deeply, but my impression is that the wave function is an ontic object that serves the role of a potential. And when you perform some action over here, that causes the wave function to redistribute itself non-locally throughout space, so instantaneously. So does anyone have any, probably people who know more about Bohmian mechanics than I do in the audience, maybe not. Anyways, but I think that's basically the mechanism. Oops.
A criticism of the theory?
Well, no, it can't be. It used to be, but it can't be, right?
But why it can't be?
Well, it can't be in the sense that if you want to believe that there is some ontology at all that's unique, unlike many worlds where the ontology is non-unique, if you believe there's a unique ontology for the world, whether it's von Neumann's view or some hidden variable theory, we know that it has to be non-local. So the idea is that, and actually we'll come to this later. Well, that's the thing. So Bell's theorem tells you hidden variables have to be non-local. But the EPR paradox tells you that that the literal realism of von Neumann has to be non-local. So a non-hidden variable theory, like von Neumann's, is also non-local. So the only way around non-locality is a kind of a many worlds, is to let go of reality, basically.
Von Neumann doesn't need any interaction to explain. I guess here you need interaction to explain. Interaction between space time.
What do you mean?
I mean, in the von Neumann interpretation, I mean, you don't need interaction for collapse of the two other parties. I mean, the other party, when you measure your Hamiltonian system here.
There's no kind of physical mechanism for the non-locality, is that what you mean?
There's no Hamiltonian, there's no interaction.
Well, I mean, you're doing a measurement over here, and that's causing a collapse of the wave function over there. But I think von Neumann gets away with not having an explicit non-local mechanism only because he provides no mechanism at all for collapse. It's just, you know, by fiat, collapse occurs. So, I mean, that's, unless I'm misunderguessing your question.
But I guess, if you have, I mean, in hidden variable theories, you need some interaction.
Well, yeah, usually, I mean, hidden variable theories would have some kind of physical mechanism that would account for the non-locality, some kind of explicit mechanism. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, and in a sense, you can say von Neumann interpretation is more consistent with relativity than this, and compared to this.
Maybe you could say that. As we'll see later, I mean, they're all consistent with relativity. They're just not consistent with the spirit of relativity. Okay, am I still on this slide? Oh no, yeah, okay, I'm still on this slide. So what does it mean to interpret a theory? So as we've kind of touched upon throughout the last couple of weeks, what we want is some kind of minimum set of rules that allows us to, you know, use the mathematical formalism and interpret events in the world. So on the one hand, you have the mathematical formalism, and on the other hand, you have things that happen in the world or in the lab. And what you want is some rule that relates these objects, draws lines between them. And so these are called, in philosophy of science, these are called bridge principles. And so here I'm calling them operational bridge principles because this, just to distinguish from later, we'll talk about ontological bridge principles. So the operational bridge principle is the minimum you need to use the theory, which makes a theory not a mathematical theory, but a physical theory, which is something that can predict phenomena. So in quantum theory, what are these operational bridge principles? So on the one hand, we need to associate preparations, we need to associate density operators with preparations, and we need to associate measurement operators with measurements, so say projectors with measurements. And so this requires actually some background knowledge. It's not actually, you know, given to us by the theory, right? So we need a way to identify what the right mathematical objects are that are to be associated with certain procedures we carry out in the lab. So on the one hand, there's kind of symmetry arguments you can use to identify the appropriate operators. There's you can bootstrap from classical mechanics. And also, to some extent, there's going to be calibration procedures when you're doing something very complicated in the lab. You don't actually know what the right operator is to model that measurement or that preparation. And so you actually have to do tests to determine and kind of like feedback to find out exactly the right way to model it. And of course, to do that calibration step, you need kind of what's probably the most significant or evident bridge principle, which is just Born's rule, which assigns, you know, relative frequencies to the outcomes associated with preparations and measurements.
Maybe this is just a small aside, but because we always talk about observables and associating them with self-adjoint operators. So in this case, if you have a minimal interpretation, then you don't need it to work the other way around, which is I don't need all self-adjoint operators to have some physical observable associated with them. Is that right?
That's a good question. There might be some reason why it's required, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. Does anybody have any ideas about that? Yeah. Well, I guess if you imagine you have some like continuous dial on the apparatus where you can change the, say, direction of measurement of some Stern Gerlach device, that's going to buy you an uncountably infinite number of possible measurements. Yeah, I think that is a deep question, though. I mean, I think the standard understanding of quantum mechanics is that you can do anything in the lab. And the reason for that is because, actually, we know this. One of the ways we know this is because of some of the basics of quantum information, which tells you that if I can do one measurement, then I know, and I can do, say, you know, quantum gates, I can do single qubit operations, and I can do an entangling gate between two qubits, then at least for powers 2 to the n, you can show that you can generate any unitary transformation. And so thereby, I can just, in the Heisenberg picture, rotate my measurement to achieve any measurement I want. So in principle, the belief is that you could obtain any, at least in finite dimensional Hilbert space, you could do any measurement you want. Where am I here? Okay, so let me just call this the minimum statistical interpretation. It's, we just say quantum mechanics makes statistical predictions about what outcomes may be found when specified measurement procedures are performed upon specified preparation procedures. And the relative frequency of those outcomes is given by Born's rule. I should probably have that in there. But that's basically all you need. And you can go and do physics and, you know, get Nobel Prizes and things like that, right? So this is an ontology-free interpretation of quantum mechanics. And it's this kind of cop-out in the sense that it, just a minute, Cos, in the sense that it doesn't, you know, it leaves you wanting more, perhaps. Cosman?
What do you mean by ontology-free? Should measurement outcomes in your apparatus have some status?
Well, that's a good point. So I guess what I was trying to... I mean, I agree with that, that the measurement outcome is real, but I'm trying to decide if that's something that's real. In a sense, it's something that's real, but it's not, I can't see how it points to something in the theory. I mean, so if you have a measurement operator E sub K, so K is the index labeling that outcome, right? And to some extent, that index is arbitrary. So, you know, my outcome is in units of, you know, meters, and my index K is just some label, or continuous label in that case. But what I'm, I guess what I was, what I had in mind when I said that was, that you're not, what I had in mind was that there's, you write down kind of, you know, your mathematical theory, and you list all the mathematical objects in the theory, and you don't need to associate any of those objects with elements of reality. And I guess what you're saying is that, well, yeah, you need to associate the label of the label on the measurement operator with something you observe in the lab. So I, yeah, maybe that's right. Yeah, I guess that's another way to answer the question, actually. Yeah, so you could take this extreme kind of solipsistic, or however you pronounce that, point of view where, you know, there is no reality, I just have my personal observations, and they're subjective. But I agree, that's not, I think that's a, I don't, you know, like that answer. But, okay, so it's almost ontology-free, let's put it that way. But I think, does everyone understand, I guess, the point I'm trying to get at, which is that we're making, I guess, the minimum ontological commitments we have to. There's no superfluous ontology. I just like the phrase ontology-free, I guess. So, but the point is that quantum theory, aside possibly from these labels on your measurement operators, which are associated to measurement outcomes, it doesn't try to tell you anything about the way the world is. And so because of that, there's no measurement problem. Now notice that I've ignored transformations in my definition, and that's because you can always imagine the transformations to be absorbed into the preparations or the measurements, and they just redefine. If I'm doing a measurement x followed by some transformation t, I can just act t on x to get a new measurement x prime. So this minimal statistical interpretation is, you know, with a grain of salt, ordinary textbook quantum mechanics. And the grain of salt is that you have to, you know, cross out with your pen the lip service paid to Bohr and von Neumann and Dirac in the you know, semi-philosophical epilogue you find, for example, in Liebhoff. This is actually probably the first thing that drove me nuts in quantum mechanics. Was at the end of one of his first few chapters, Liebhoff has this semi-philosophical epilogue where he talks about interpretations. And left me pulling my hair out. Anyhow, so from a pragmatic point of view, one can be totally content with this interpretation. It's the minimum that everyone has to agree upon, and it's basically the idea of what's this shut up and calculate school of thought. And so Stephen Hawking really captures the spirit of this idea when he says, when I hear about Schrodinger's cat, I reach for my gun. Now, I've heard this many times, but I couldn't find the source of it. Do you know, Remo? Was it in his book, or is it just something he said and someone quoted him as saying?
So I've heard many times that Sanders quoted. I think it's in the universe.
Yeah. Because apparently, what I've heard, for example, is this famous Einstein quote, God does not play dice. That apparently was an attribution to Einstein that he never actually said. And he was quite clear, actually, in a lot of his writing, well, later on in his writings, because for him, the idea of determinism wasn't really the crucial thing he wanted to cling to. It was realism. So this minimal statistical interpretation can be called an operationalist interpretation or an instrumentalist interpretation. Perez put it in his textbook, in a strict sense, quantum theory is a set of rules allowing computation of probabilities for the outcomes of tests which follow specified preparations. In fact, I should have just used that as my definition. But basically, we have this input-output theory. And so, like Victor, you were complaining about, the theory now has no more ontological significance than an instruction manual. And so I also, as I alluded to when I was answering your question, there's this subtle difference between the statistical interpretation of Einstein and Ballantyne and this operationalist view, which is that Einstein and Ballantyne were committed to the idea that a more complete theory should be possible, whereas you don't have to take on that view if you want to just use quantum mechanics. Yeah, Luke?
The problem is, so in this interpretation of quantum mechanics, so the theory is saying something about a sequence preparation, a sequence of equations, because the probability is you interpret them as sequences, right?
Yeah.
So you can say that we need a theory without speaking about any ontology. Just tell me in this particular measurement why, no, not why, what outcome I get. So a rule which tells me, okay, if you prepare this and measure this, you get this for sure. Without committing to an ontology. In this sense, it is incomplete, but we are not speaking about an ontology. So we can have a theory which is ontology-free in your sense, but yet which is more complete than the theory, because it gives us more precise, or not more precise, it gives us more detail in each instance. It tells us exactly what we have. This theory is just telling us about frequencies. So if I just make one measurement, I cannot apply my theory at all.
You mean a hidden variable theory gives you more detail? What are you thinking gives you more detail?
Just a theory which, like a set of recipes, which tells me if you do this in the laboratory, you put this measurement apparatus just once, you get this out. Just a recipe. You do this, you get this, without ontology. But for this particular instance of the
so, I mean, are you imagining where the probability is one there? The situations where you have probability one of an outcome?
Well, for example, if I don't know, still getting a couple what you want. And I just do it the experiment once. I see a spot here or here.
So the question can be, do I have a theory which tells me for this particular experiment, if I get this spot here or here, without speaking about the electrons or waves or whatever, no ontology.
Which correct is what
just telling me what I will see if I after I've done this experiment.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, so you're talking about single shot versus ensemble.
Yeah.
And but I mean the point is you can't predict single shot outcomes. That I mean except under very special circumstance. So that's not the empirical case to explain, right?
It's not a hidden variable. I'm not speaking about hidden variables, but I'm speaking about a theory which is operational just like this, but it's more gives me more details.
So not quantum theory.
No.
Okay.
No, but because with the previous slide, I was thinking about this because. The previous one as well. It was something about it then.
Go all the way back.
It was a slide with the citing Einstein and Valentine.
Yeah. Yes, I should have read this because it has one of my favorite words in it. The idea was to disabuse the scientists of their paradoxes and conceptual confusions that plague that interpretation of quantum mechanics. Sorry. Can we take this up afterwards? Because I'd like to move on, if you don't mind. Oh, where are we? Oh, you're good. So John Bell basically, puts it best, and he says, ordinary quantum mechanics, well, as far as we know, is just fine for all practical purposes. So this is what he called FAPP. But the point is, what is really going on? We maybe want something more. First of all, just for personal satisfaction, we might want something more. And secondly, it might help us understand the theory better. So I'll motivate it in a moment, but basically the idea is what we need is a set of ontological bridge principles beyond any implicit ontology in my ontology-free minimal statistical interpretation. So that is not just to say that, okay, I acknowledge that the measurement outcome I observe is something that exists, but what is actually going on before the measurement and after the measurement and so on. And so here, again, we use the idea of a bridge principle from philosophy of science, but now it's an ontological bridge principle, not an operational bridge principle. And the idea of the bridge principle is it's really something that draws relations between, imagine, Venn diagrams. You have a set of mathematical elements in the theory, and you have a set of things you believe that exist in the world, like coffee mugs and elephants and stars, and you want to draw connections between them. Say, this object of the theory corresponds to this object in the world. And so the idea of the word ontology is from this Greek word ontos, which just means to be. So it's things that exist. And so this is, the idea is maybe we do, maybe we don't, but one thing you might like is for quantum mechanics to have some kind of explanatory power about what's going on in the world. You also hope that the ontological bridge principles might give some intuition about how to reason about quantum systems and anticipate results when, say, direct calculation isn't feasible, or come up with ideas about what kinds of things quantum mechanics can do. I mean, I guess I forgot to mention this point earlier on, but for me, you look at the fact that we've had quantum mechanics now for, say, take 1930 as a point, 80 years we've had quantum theory. So in 1994, we had quantum theory for 64 years, and no one had realized that or shown that quantum computing could lead to, that quantum effects could lead to more powerful computation. So the idea is, I think that what that shows us is that there's a lack of intuition about the theory, that, what is it good for? And, I think that's in part because we don't really have good ways of thinking about it. And so not only can having a deeper understanding of quantum mechanics hopefully give you insight into, properties of the world that quantum mechanics gives us that we don't know about yet, but also can, this outstanding issue of unifying quantum mechanics with gravity. Okay, so now let's start looking at some concrete examples of ontological interpretations of theories. So you take classical mechanics, by which I mean Newtonian mechanics or Hamilton's equations of motion or Lagrange's equations of motion. And there you have, for a simple one-dimensional system, you have position and momentum, Q and P, that are the properties of the system. These are objective properties. That's the ontic state. The state space is the phase space. These physical properties evolve deterministically according to dynamical laws, and they give a complete specification in the sense that any relevant physical facts about the system can be deduced from knowledge of Q and P at some time. And combined with knowledge of Q and P at some time and the deterministic laws, which is a second-order differential equation, you can determine the values of these properties at any time. Now, what's an example of a theory that, for which the state is not ontological? Well, a very good example of this is Liouville mechanics. So Liouville asked the question, okay, we know Hamilton's equations of motion, but in practice, I don't actually have infinite precision knowledge of the position and the momentum. What I really have is some, you know, probabilistic information about where the position is and where what the momentum is. So suppose you wanted to ask the question, instead of just knowing how the center of that probability distribution evolves according to Hamilton's equations of motion, you want to ask, how does all of my information, my probabilistic information, evolve in time under Hamilton's equations of motion? And so therefore, you ascribe your state in the theory is a probability density, rho, which is a function of Q and P and time. And then the state evolves linearly and deterministically under a partial differential equation, which is very reminiscent of the von Neumann equation. I probably, you know, I didn't check if my minus sign is right there or not. I'll leave that to So there may be a minus sign there that's missing. But the point is that it's, you know, the parallels between it and quantum mechanics are quite strong. So the point is the states of this theory don't have an ontological meaning. They have an epistemic meaning. They represent information or knowledge about the system properties. So the actual states of Liouville mechanics, excluding Dirac delta function states, are states of incomplete information. So the point is, if you have a theory, and it evolves according to, you know, a von Neumann type equation, and then the states need not be ontic states. They might reflect just information rather than actual physics. The properties are the argument of the state and not the state itself. So I meant to prepare a slide here on, well, I'll mention it later.
Does the Liouville model bring any new information that, you know, the Newtonian
model doesn't? Well, in a sense, it's less information, right? Because the idea is you don't know the position precisely, you just know. So it turns out then you get this long list, you get this laundry list of properties, which you think are properties of quantum mechanics, which actually occur in this Liouville theory. So I'll get to that. So now that we've seen two examples of theories, the question is, well, what are quantum states? Are they more like classical phase-space points, or are they more like probability densities in the Liouville picture? Or do quantum states have aspects of both? So if they're epistemic, like Liouville states, then that means it's information about some other ontology, about some other ontic properties. And so what would those ontic properties be? And they would be hidden because they're not explicit in the formalism. And then the other question you can ask, which might not be obvious that you could answer it, but turns out you can, is what kinds of constraints do we know these ontic variables have to satisfy if they exist? These hidden variables, I should say. And can you construct a fully deterministic hidden variable theory in this setting? Adam?
Yeah, I could just go back to the previous 9 seconds. Right, you said the point of is the states of a theory need not be ontic states. It's that their arguments are ontic states. Mm-hmm. So, like in the case of the Liouville mechanics, we're saying that the particle actually has position and momentum,
yep.
But we don't know it, mm-hmm. And what the state of the particle in our theory is this probability distribution.
I'd say the description of the particle in the theory is by this probability density.
Okay.
And the thing you call a state is the probability density.
Right. But we can say that in classical, it's kind of assumed, or our starting point is that the particle actually has position momentum.
Yes.
The problem is when we transition into quantum theory, even though I think at the beginning of last term I asked you the comparisons between this Liouville theory and quantum mechanics, because there's so many formal similarities, right? It seems like when you go to the quantum regime, now you can't, or if you tried to say that the particle actually has some kind of quantic state, then you run into these problems. But you need not, in the case of Liouville mechanics, assume that the, or no, I guess you do have to assume that the particle has a quantic state.
Well, that's the natural interpretation. But the point would be to do something different.
Well, it's just like, I mean, what if you can just say, just as in quantum mechanics, the Liouville function, or whatever, your probability distribution, that's all that you can't know. It doesn't make sense to ask about, or to think about the particle actually having a position of momentum. You can only say, these are the possible results for what we get.
In which setting? Those statements apply to what?
Like,
well, I mean, no, I mean...
Throw away the ontic status of the problem, of the particle.
Well, hold on. I mean, so if you want to construct, as I will do in a slide or two, I'll talk about these analogies between Liouville mechanics and quantum mechanics. For example, it explains the measurement problem. But the only way it explains it is if you assume that the measurement outcome is determined by these ontic properties Q and V. Otherwise, it hasn't really bought you that much. So I don't know if, and maybe we should take that up after class, because I don't know how to answer that. Victor?
So just to make this a little bit more concrete, just you know, to make sure I'm understanding, if I take like a tennis ball and put it in a shoebox, and then I throw it across the room, I can represent the time evolution of the position of the tennis ball using Liouville mechanics classically, right?
Right.
And then I'd write my state, rho, as a function of the ontic variable of the tennis ball's actual position and the ontic properties of my shoebox. Is that right? Or are we not saying, like, what exactly are the ontic properties that go in to have my to develop my epistemic state in that classical scenario, right? Like what are we considering ontic and what's epistemic?
Okay, so you have, anyway, so you have your phase space. So this is Q, and this is P. And the idea that these are physical properties of the system. So actually, an interesting question is, why is momentum a physical property at all? Or why do you assume momentum is physical? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is because it's a second-order differential equation, or it's a pair of coupled first-order differential equations, the classical dynamics. So it's an initial condition that's needed to specify. But it's a coupled set of equations. So in some sense, different choices of P cause Q to have different values later in time. So it has this kind of causal power. So that's just a digression. But so you want to think of P as being physical. And then when you have a Liouville state, I'll just draw like a contour map. And this would be some probability density. It would be assigned at some time t. And so the point is that the particle is somewhere, say it's there, and you don't know where it is. But what you know is that it has some probability of being in these different locations. But it is actually in some location. So when I write down rho of QPT, I'm not actually specifying what the ontic state is of this particular system. So Q and P parameterize the possible properties of the particle. But I'm not saying that it is this property.
So what's confusing me then is that if we go back to my shoebox example, right? It seems like we can describe ontologically the position, the momentum of the shoebox, and from that we get our state operator, right? But in quantum mechanics, you're trying to take the particle and say, you know, there's some ontological position momentum, and that's giving us our state operator, right? But it seems like our particle, our electron, is analogous to the tennis ball, right? Whereas classically, ontologically, we're describing the shoebox, right? So This sounds really unclear as it's coming out of my
mouth. No, the point, I mean, I think forget about the shoebox. Just think about, you know, think about the shoebox as constraints on the possible values the position of the particle can take on. So you're saying, well, the particle can either be, you know, in this band of Q, or it can be in this band of Q, because these correspond to the two halves of the shoebox, say, after I've separated the shoebox. So I wouldn't think of them so much as, I mean, obviously they're made up of particles that have their own ontology, but I think it's simpler just to think of the shoebox walls as constraints. Now, Adam, I think these two questions maybe both might be a result of, maybe I misspoke when I said that the argument of the probability density is the ontic state. I think that's not quite fair to say, because really the argument is a parameterization of the possible values of the ontic state. And maybe that's what you were getting at.
But why don't we just replace that with the argument is a parameterization of the possible measurement outcomes you will get. And I don't see how loop-field mechanics is any different than quantum mechanics.
Because we're trying to answer this question. What is really going on? So yes, you could operationally do that for Liouville mechanics, and maybe that's what you were getting at. You can avoid, but no, but the purpose of this discussion is to say, how does one go about making ontological commitments? But I agree, now I understand what you're saying, and yes, I agree, you could do that. Where are we? You had a question,
you just
Luke.
Said what I wanted to say.
Okay, all right, wow. Boy, one slip of the tongue, and I spend 10 minutes explaining myself. Yeah.
So if you interpret quantum state as some object, does it imply that fundamentally you believe that there is some hidden fundamental hidden variable theory that you don't know the values, but there should exist? Is there any specific point of quantum state without believing?
Yeah, I would say that's the minimal statistical interpretation. I mean, I think when you use...
Because I mean, this analogy with Liouville, I mean, it suggests that in that case, there is some fundamental theory.
Yes, yes.
It's hidden variable.
That's the point of the analogy, yeah.
But, and then you interpret this parallel distribution as some epistemic.
Right.
So now, it suggests that if you want to do the same thing with quantum state, you somehow believe that there is some fundamental hidden variable theory that you don't know the values, but there should be.
Yes, yes.
So you can't believe in epistemic, you can't interpret quantum state as epistemic object and say, I don't believe in hidden variable theory.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the word epistemic doesn't really have a kind of an established meaning in this context. Different people use it differently. But I think that the spirit of what you're asking, which is, can you just take an interpretation of the quantum state where it's not ontic, say, at least, and yet refuse to believe that there are hidden variables. I think you can, and I think that that's basically what the operational interpretation does. I think it's also the kind of thing that Chris Fuchs might advocate, but you'd have to ask him, because he's going to talk about that. So, I mean, I think you can take this point of view that quantum mechanics is this theory that describes probabilities, but there is no fundamental ontology underlying quantum mechanics. Okay, great. So basically, yes, so you have all these questions about what's going on if the states are epistemic, and you can add your Iman's question, which is, you know, or maybe there are no hidden variables at all. You know, I tend to use the word epistemic to mean that you're committed to this idea that there are, you have information about something, not just the outcomes of future measurements, which is the operational view, but about something ontic at all times. Now, if quantum states, on the other hand, are ontic, which we're not going to really consider anymore, then the question is, are they the complete picture? Is it the complete ontology? So is it the whole story, as in von Neumann's picture, or is there some kind of maybe additional hidden variables? So de Broglie-Bohm actually fits into this first category here, in that the quantum states are ontic, but there are additional hidden variables, namely the positions and the momenta. And then, you know, given the specific details of your interpretation, you have to worry about how you overcome the measurement problem. So I think a good way to think about all this stuff is this ontological models framework, which I think the term was coined by Rob. I don't know if anybody knows if it predates that. But anyhow, the idea is, let's just build a structure which we can start locating these various approaches within. And so you start out by specifying there's some set lambda, which is this set of properties of the world, and any particular state, ontic state, is an element of that set. And the idea is that, you know, lowercase lambda is the real state of affairs. So it's the ontology of the system. So for a classical Hamiltonian system of n particles in three dimensions, the ontic spaces, the phase space, are 3n. Three-dimensional real vector space. Now we want to not just have some ontic space, we want to construct a whole theory that can make predictions. So what we want to talk about is we want to associate with preparations, we want to associate some probability measure on the ontic space, which basically you could think of this as just a probability density, and you want measurements to be conditional probabilities. So the way you read this is, if I'm doing some measurement configuration, and I'm talking about measurement outcome k, then the idea would be this would say, be the probability, the conditional probability you get outcome k, given that the ontic state actually is lambda. And then this, so your probability of k is the preparation probability of getting each lambda multiplied by the conditional probability of outcome k given lambda. So now, let's look at an example. What does Liouville mechanics look like in this picture? So our preparation, our measure mu, is some probability density. It's a function of x, p, and t. The ontic space lambda is R3n, as I mentioned earlier. And then suppose you're doing some measurement. So this is a two-dimensional. This is R2 here. And now, the idea of a measurement is this. So let K index each of these boxes. And then, so let's pick out some K naught. As that box right there. And then this contour map gives us the probability distribution associated with the preparation for preparing different Qs and Ps. So we have lambda is equal to the pair QP, and capital lambda is equal to R2. And then the idea is that, well, the probability of finding the particle in this box when you repeat the experiment many, many times, is going to be, well, you insert the probability density, and then given that you're looking, if it's in this box, you want a function C of K that's equal to 1. You know, I guess what I need to do is, let's call this region, I call that region K naught. C of K naught is equal to 1 if the ontic state lambda is in this set, where S is this subregion of R2 indexed by K naught. And then C is equal to 0 otherwise. And then we have some, you know, measure on the space, d lambda. So this is how you would describe a measurement procedure classically. So you divide the whole possible space into boxes, and then you check if the particle is in one particular box, and the probability is controlled by these simple rules. So in this case, we have, this is called an idempotent indicator function, which is the simplest case, which is, it's just a yes or no answer. So it's equal to its own square. Now here's a good point to mention the analogy with quantum mechanics. So after the measurement, suppose I get outcome the outcome yes, meaning I get outcome, I get the outcome k naught. So here what I'm saying is this. You're dividing your possible phase space into this box, this set of boxes. And I just ask the question, I don't look where it is exactly, but I just have some kind of measurement device that tells me which box it's in without telling me where it is in the box. And also I assume it's non-disturbing, say, okay? So suppose I get outcome k naught, which means that the particle is found to be in the box k naught. Then I want to describe the state after measurement. So then the state after measurement, I need an update rule, which is going to be, let's hope I get this right now. It's going to be rho k naught, where rho k naught is going to be equal to the initial rho restricted to this region. So I think it's going to be C of k naught times rho, now this isn't normalized, so we want to normalize it, sorry about this, I hope you can still see, where we just take this whole object here and put it in the denominator so that we have a normalized state. So rho k naught integrates to 1 now. So now notice this transformation is a lot like the update rule in quantum mechanics. So how much like the update rule is it? Well, it turns out you can make the analogy extremely strong. So this is something that Cosman and I looked at quite a bit. Basically, you can cast Liouville mechanics as a Hilbert space theory. Then the transformations engendered by the Liouville equation are represented by unitary transformations on this space. This is via Koopman's theorem. So the vectors in this Hilbert space, which is a real Hilbert space, are the square roots of the probability densities. Is that right, Cos? They're square roots, right? And then in particular, if you have n particles in three dimensions, then your Hilbert space is L2 R 6n, whereas for quantum mechanics, your Hilbert space, and we didn't cover infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but hopefully you've seen enough of it to know what this all means. So you change the dimension of the real vector space. So L2 means square integrable functions, right? So if I take the square of this vector, I get rho back and it integrates to 1. And this is analogous to the fact that when you want to get probabilities in quantum mechanics, you have to take the modulus squared of the complex wave function. Here you just take the square of the real vector. And the reason why you have to have this bigger space is because you have to have non-commutativity. And so one of the really interesting things that Cos showed me, which is I guess these mathematical physicists of the 70s all sorted out, is that what happens is in the quantum mechanical setting, the object which generates translations in position is the same operator which corresponds to measurements of momentum. So the momentum operator generates translations in position. In the real Hilbert space of Liouville mechanics, those are distinct mathematical objects. Anyhow, the point is that transformations in Liouville mechanics are given by unitary transformations acting on this vector space, and you can reproduce the Born rule and everything. But now when you go to represent measurement in the Liouville setting, this measurement procedure is given by some non-unitary transformation. In fact, not only is it non-unitary, it's non-linear. And it's, of course, stochastic, because you don't know where the particle was, so you can only perform the update after you see the outcome. And each time you repeat the experiment, you get a different outcome. So basically, it has all the properties of the collapse of the wave function. And I should probably mention here that, so you can think of this update rule as just Bayesian update. It's an instance of Bayesian update of your information. So now all of a sudden you realize that, well, if I think of my quantum states as being epistemic objects like the Liouville state, then, you know, collapse is completely trivial. It's obvious what's going on. Is there anything else I should add to this, Cosmin, that to strengthen the analogy?
To strengthen the analogy?
Or to weaken it?
I was just going to mention entanglement. There's no entanglement in the Liouville one.
Yes, so when you take tensor product structures, yeah, so obviously you have to have, you can't.
That's one major difference.
Yeah. So it is a different theory, yeah. Are all unitaries allowed?
Oh, I don't know.
So Adam, I know you're interested in more mathematical subjects. So this gets very sophisticated very fast, this discussion, because it's all infinite dimensional Hilbert space issues, which are highly non-trivial. So, but I mean in terms of like the course project, for example. Okay, so anyway, so because this is something I wanted to motivate an epistemic interpretation of quantum mechanics through that. There are other reasons as well. But so the point is this, as Cosmin just pointed out, if you construct this kind of a theory out of Liouville mechanics, sure, you can construct an epistemic theory and you can put it in the ontological model framework, but it's not going to reproduce quantum mechanics. For one thing, because of this tensor product issue, if your Hilbert space is a tensor product. So the idea is if you want an ontological model that reproduces the prediction of quantum mechanics, then you want this integral to be equal to the Born rule, where remember, you have some preparation procedure that gets mapped onto some measure in your ontological model, and it gets mapped onto some density operator in your quantum theory, and similarly for the measurements. And so you want this equality to hold if you're going to reproduce quantum mechanics, if you're going to give a hidden variable interpretation of quantum mechanics. So there are many examples of ontological models that reproduce the predictions of quantum theory. And if we restrict ourselves to two-dimensional Hilbert space, then we can actually build one out of a restricted version of this Liouville mechanics. So in terms of terminology, let me just define a hidden variable theory then, which is the most important class of these ontological models, as one where, say, at least one pure quantum state is associated with the probability measure on the ontic space that has support on more than one element of the ontic space. So this means that the ontic state is not fully specified by the measure representing the preparation. So an example of an ontological model that is not a hidden variable model is the Beltrametti-Bujaski model. So here you take this interesting turn, which is you say, okay, well let me call my ontic space just the complex projective Hilbert space itself. And so this kind of sphere in black, so I took this picture from a paper by Harrigan and Rudolph. The sphere in black represents the complex projective space. You have some preparation psi, which is a ray in the complex projective space, or equivalent to a ray. And then you associate you want to construct, remember, you want to measure on your ontic space that represents that preparation. Well, you construct it as the delta function located on that projector. I guess, strictly speaking, this shouldn't be a projector. It should just be a ket, or an equivalence class of kets. And then by convexity, we can construct any other preparation, if it's a, you know, a convex combination of pure states. And the measurement operators, sorry about the writing here, the measurement operators are represented by these conditional probabilities, which we just assign the values of the conditional probability to be exactly what the Born rule tells you if lambda were the preparation, which it's not. The preparation is psi. So you get this kind of a function on the space. And then it follows trivially because of the properties of the delta function that when you perform this integration with mu and c defined as I just did, you're going to reproduce the Born rule. So what you see here is this is an ontological model, which is just making formal the idea of the von Neumann-Dirac interpretation, which is that basically reality is the state vector itself. To what extent that's consistent with our experience and other properties of quantum mechanics is the measurement problem, but nonetheless, that's what it says reality is. So now a more interesting example of a hidden variable model is the quotient Speckr model. So this reproduces quantum predictions for arbitrary states and for proper POVMs on a two-dimensional Hilbert space. So you take the ontic space to be the two-sphere, just the sphere, and it's just basically the space you'd expect if you had an angular momentum of fixed length, which was free to rotate with angles theta and phi. So this model can be completely described using classical Liouville mechanics. So this means that a single qubit is completely classical. So here's a picture representing it. This is from Ryan Morris's thesis. So basically, you construct the pure states are represented by cos theta distributions illustrated in red. So imagine if your preparation is the state plus z. Then you construct a probability distribution on this two-sphere that has this cos theta form and has zero support on the opposite hemisphere. So, and of course, the direction on the two-sphere is just given by the direction of the expectation values.
What sense are you using the term support?
As in, it has non-zero value. Is there something incorrect?
No, you just think.
Oh, I didn't define it. Oh, okay.
The set where the whatever it doesn't.
The set where the,
or the closure,
where the function is non-zero, basically. And then projective measurements are modeled just by idempotent indicator functions, which basically they're constant functions on a hemisphere. And so the idea is this. If you want to model a qubit using classical physics, figure out what the preparation, someone tells you I'm doing this preparation, it's modeled by this projector. Just draw a random variable according to this cos theta distribution each time you repeat the experiment and let the point be placed on the surface of the sphere with that probability. Then when you're told what the measurement is, you just say, is the point in this hemisphere or not? And that's the outcome. So the outcome will be yes or no along this direction. And in repeating that, where the point is you input this randomness in the preparation, you reproduce exactly the predictions of quantum mechanics for a qubit. So we've gone over time, but so actually this is where I start leading into Bell's theorem, which I guess we're not going to cover. So Gregor is going to be covering it, discussing his experimental tests of Gregor Weiss will be discussing experimental tests of Bell's inequality, so he will be covering it then. And what I will do is I'll put some elements of this on an assignment, which now that I'm done the lectures, I can finally spend time getting the assignments ready. And I'll put these slides online. This is where my formatting kind of ended anyways. I'll put these slides online. I go through von Neumann's REC, There's a definition of Einstein locality there. I go through Bell's theorem in detail, and some of this doesn't look so bad, and make a few, you know, pithy remarks, and then it all comes to a glorious end. Okay, great. So I guess I'll just cover a few logistical issues, which is we should probably set a deadline of, say, mid-February for submitting proposals for your project, so there's time for feedback. So just submit one paragraph and a list of references to us, and we'll give you some feedback on maybe suggested other references or possible modifications to the topic. And trying to get that back to you within a week or so you can start making progress. You're welcome to submit the proposal earlier if you want to get a head start. And I will put some assignments on the webpage that will be with appropriate due dates and all that. Adam?
Position of proposals, if we're not sure what
this is. That's perfectly fine. It will have to be a classical mixture, though, because otherwise it'll collapse when I look at it. Okay, great. Thank you.